Scholarship was far from absent. Despite the chaos farther north, the astronomer Aryabhata, who had his home in the Gupta domain, had by 499 calculated the value of pi and the exact length of the solar year, and suggested that perhaps the Earth was a sphere that moved around the sun while rotating on its axis. This was most certainly an assertion about a universal pattern, but it was an observation, not an attempt to impose meaning on a scattered variety of political events. The Indian kingdoms of the southeastern coast traded across the Indian Ocean with the islands farther east, the large island of Sumatra and the smaller island of Java. We do not know a great deal about these kingdoms, apart from their ongoing trade with India. On the southern end of Sumatra, a kingdom called Kantoli was in its very early stages. It would develop further in the next century. While on the northern end of Java, the kingdom of Tarumanagara was ruled by King Chandrawarman. Between the two islands lay the mountain of Krakatoa, a volcano, slowly building up a head of steam and lava beneath its ice-capped surface. In 535, Krakatoa erupted. Author's note, probably. David Keyes has done an extensive review of the evidence for a disastrous 535 eruption of Krakatoa in his 1999 book Catastrophe, Ballantine Books. Other dates have been suggested, but tree ring data seem to make the 535 date most likely. The explosion hurled pieces of the mountain through the air to land as far as 7 miles away. Tons of ash and vaporized salt water exploded upwards into the air, forming a plume perhaps 30 miles high. The land around the volcano collapsed inward, forming a cauldron of rushing seawater 30 miles across. The Indonesian Chronicle, the Book of Ancient Kings, describes a tidal wave sweeping across Sumatra and Java, which at the time may have been a single island. The inhabitants were drowned and swept away with all their property, it reads, and after the water subsided, the mountain and the surrounding land became sea, and the island had been divided into two parts. The Book of Ancient Kings is not entirely reliable, since this account comes from a much later transcription and may reflect more recent eruptions. But the Indonesian records are not the only ones that testify to a 535 disaster. The effects of Krakatoa's eruption rippled across a much wider landscape. In China, where the sound of the explosion was recorded in the history of the Southern Dynasties, yellow dust rained down like snow. Procopius reports that in 536, all the way over in the Byzantine domain, the sun gave forth its light without brightness, like the moon, during this whole year, and it seemed exceedingly like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it shed were not clear. Michael the Syrian writes, "The sun was dark, and its darkness lasted for 18 months. Each day it shone for about 4 hours, and still this light was only a feeble shadow. The fruits did not ripen, and the wine tasted like sour grapes." The ash from the explosion was spreading across the sky, blocking the sun's heat. In Antarctica and Greenland, acid snow began to fall and continued to blanket the ice for 4 years. 2 years later, in the early fall of 538, the Roman senator Cassiodorus, serving at the Ostrogoth court in Ravenna, lamented in a letter to one of his officials, "The sun, first of stars, seems to have lost his wonted light and appears of a bluish color. We marvel to see no shadows of our bodies at noon, to feel the mighty vigor of his heat wasted into feebleness, and the phenomena which accompany a transitory eclipse prolonged through a whole year. The moon, too, even when her orb is full, is empty of her natural splendor. Strange has been the course of the year thus far. We have had a winter without storms, a spring without mildness, and a summer without heat. Whence can we look for harvest, since the months which should have been maturing the corn have been chilled? The seasons seem to be all jumbled up together, and the fruits, which were wont to be formed by gentle showers, cannot be looked for from the parched earth. The apples harden when they should grow ripe, souring the old age of the grape cluster. Crop failure was not limited to the east. Tree-ring data from as far away as modern Chile, California, and Siberia show a drastic drop in summer growth from around 535 until about 540. This testifies to cold, dark summers. The darkening of the sun was producing plague, hunger, and famine across the medieval world. And to the east, the civilizations on the islands of Sumatra and Java were destroyed. In Tarumanagara, King Chandrawarman was killed. His heir, Suryawarman, moved the capital of his kingdom farther east, away from the site of the catastrophe. But the kingdom had been dealt a death blow. The once thriving culture on the island was reduced to shambles. All that is left now are a few inscriptions and the foundations of destroyed temples to the gods of Hinduism and to the Buddha. Chapter 27. The Americas. Between circa 500 and circa 600, the cities of Mesoamerica flourish until drought and famine strike. The ash from Krakatoa, blown by winds far above the earth, circled the globe for 5 years. On the other side of the world, summers grew cold and grey. Drought struck the forests and fields of the Americas, and for 30 years crop-killing dryness alternated with the vicious flooding brought on by unnaturally frequent El Niño events. Author's note, an El Niño event occurs when the surface temperature of the Pacific Ocean near the South American coast warms significantly. The change shifts weather patterns, producing violent storms and flooding in some areas of South America. El Niño can also drastically reduce the fish population in heavily fished areas, causing difficulties for peoples who rely on them for food. The drought and flooding in Central and South America between 535 and 593 are well documented by scientists who have examined tree rings, lake deposits, and other physical evidence. Its cause is still debated. The Krakatoa eruption is, in my opinion, the most likely explanation. However, arguments have also been made for the eruption of El Chichon, or the impact of a comet in North America. While the great urban civilizations of Rome, Egypt, and the East were at their height, the peoples who lived on the land in Central America were developing complex civilizations of their own. But unlike the Romans, Egyptians, and Chinese, they did not write the histories of their rulers. The archaeologist can trace the rise and fall of cities, the carving out of trade routes, and the exchange of goods, but the historian has very little raw material to shape into a narrative. There are statues and carvings, but no explanations. There are lists of dates and rulers, but no tales of their deeds. We can start to piece together, at least, the broad outlines of a story beginning in the 6th century. On the peninsula that jutted out from the Central American land bridge into the Gulf of Mexico, a familiar phenomenon was shaping itself. A group of tribal peoples, loosely related by language and culture, building cities that tended to act in alliance, became distinct enough for us to give them a name, the Maya. Southwest of the Mayan territory, in the fertile plain known as the Valley of Oaxaca, another collection of small tribal territories was united, mostly by force, under the leadership of the strongest city among them, Monte Alban. This allows us to see them also as a single people, the Zapotec. Monte Alban became the capital city of their kingdom, a city occupied by over 20,000 people and extending for 15 square miles across ridges and valleys. Both the Maya and the Zapotec wrote. Their records are terse and enigmatic, but the very nature of the writing gives us a glimpse, although indistinct, of a very different world than the kingdoms across the oceans. The development of writing in the East and in Egypt was driven by economics, by the need to keep track of goods and payments. For the Maya and the Zapotec, writing had an entirely different function. It helped them to keep track of time. And calculating time was no simple matter. The two peoples shared a sacred calendar, one that placed great importance on birth dates and auspicious days. To us, this calendar seems almost unusably complex. It was based on multiples of 20, not 10, a vigesimal rather than decimal system, and its core was a series of 20 days, each with a different name. Each one of these days occurred 13 times during the Central American year, each time paired with a number from 1 through 13. Thus, 5 flower and 5 deer were different days, as were 5 flower and 12 flower. This yielded a total of 260 days before the sequence of names and numbers began to repeat again. If day 1 of the cycle was flower 1, the day flower 1 would not reoccur again until day 261. This 260-day cycle was the sacred round, but it did not coincide with the Earth's rounding of the sun, so it ran side by side with a 365-day calendar, restarting itself 100 days before the year's end. It took 18,930 days, approximately 52 years, for every permutation of the two calendars to play itself out, and each one of those days had significance. The skimpy written records of the Maya and the Zapotec fit each birth and death, each marriage and conquest, the accession of each ruler, into this framework. The passage of time and the connection between each day and its sacred meaning were at the center of each kingdom's history. Time was the firstborn of creation. It was born before the awakening of the world, so that every creative act, every god, and every human came into being already slotted into the intricate patterns of the calendar. The third powerful kingdom on the land bridge worked out the passage of time in a slightly different way. The kingdom was centered around the city of Teotihuacan, which in AD 500 was the sixth largest city in the entire world. Author's note: Teotihuacan is the name given to the city, long after its fall, by the Aztecs, who do not enter the historical record for some centuries yet. The city's ancient name is unknown. It was home to perhaps 125,000 people, who spoke a range of languages. Many of them had once farmed the nearby fields, and had been moved by force within the city walls, in a deliberate attempt by the kings of Teotihuacan to prevent any nearby villages from growing into cities that might challenge their power. The Teotihuacan Empire was thus entirely centered within the city walls. Like a fried egg, the meat was all in the center, and the edges were almost empty. It had the densest occupation of any Central American city, a record it would hold until the 15th century, as well as more monuments to the power of its rulers. With its identity so encircled by its borders, the city built its observation of sacred time directly into its streets and walls. Little in the way of genealogies or calendars survives from Teotihuacan, but the city itself was a matrix in which sacred time met earthly existence. The city was oriented east to west, with the western horizon, the place of the setting sun, at the top of the compass. Its map was not shaped by rivers or the rise of land. It was shaped by sunrise and sunset, the phases of the moon, and the places of the stars. Its greatest structure, the pyramid of the sun, stood at its center facing west. A channel dug through the city's center diverted water into an east-west flow. The city's major thoroughfare, the Avenue of the Dead, ran through the city from north to south, with the pyramid of the moon on the northern end. At the southern end of the Avenue of the Dead lay the pyramid of the feathered serpent, built in honor of the god who protected mankind. Details of this god and his worship are known to us only from traditions that were written down hundreds of years afterwards, and it is impossible to know how many of these customs were already followed by the 6th century. He was later known as Quetzalcoatl, and his greatest deed was to restore life to humanity after all men and women had been destroyed in a battle between rival gods. Quetzalcoatl went down into the land of the dead, ruled by the Bone Lord, Mictlantecuhtli, and retrieved the bones of a man and a woman. He then slashed his own penis, dripped blood over the bones, and restored them to life. In the religion of Teotihuacan, death was not the end, it was the beginning. Bloodshed generated life. The people of Teotihuacan, like the Maya and the Zapotec to their east, believed in a force called Tonali, a sort of radiance or animating heat that brings life. In the words of religion scholar Richard Haley, Tonali was the blood link that binds generation to generation. It comes down to humans at the time of their birth, linking the newborn to the ancestors. In return, humans offer blood back to the sky in order to complete the cycle. In the countries of the old Roman Empire, the growing Christian consensus put life and death in opposition. In Central America, life and death existed in reciprocity. The Bone Lord himself was the source not just of death, but also of life. The land of the dead was not merely an underworld, but also a place that existed side by side with the earth. So it is not surprising that the pyramid of the feathered serpent, where the temple to the protector god stood, was erected with blood. Its corners are mass graves, filled with over 200 sacrificial victims, buried in groups that reflect significant numbers in the calendar. The pyramid of the feathered serpent stood for the beginning of time, the beginning of life, and so it was also a recreation of the land of the dead, the place where and when life began. The cycles of the calendar meant that each Central American king ruled in the footprints of the king who had come before him in the previous cycle. Each of the milestones of his rule, birth, marriage, coronation, conquest, death, occupied a particular slot on that elaborate calendar, but the slots were already crowded. On the day of his coronation, a king might glance at the written chronologies and see that on that very same day, in the previous cycle, a king had died or been born. Each of the 18,930 days of the cycle was the site of both past and present events. In this way of thinking, the past was always present, and the rulers of Central America kept their power by connecting themselves to the legendary beginnings of their world. Carvings and pictographs hint at complicated bloodletting rituals, echoing the shedding of blood that first gave life back to humanity, carried out by kings. The king who cut himself on top of a pyramid was not simply copying Quetzalcoatl's actions in the distant past. He was with Quetzalcoatl, acting alongside of him, as his representative, and perhaps even as his incarnation. Declaring yourself the friend of the god, or the god himself, was a time-honored way of keeping control of your people. It was effective, too, when the people shared the same faith, which the residents of the Central American kingdoms appear, almost without exception, to have done. And as long as the gods remain powerful and popular, so does the king. Unfortunately for the kings of the mid-6th century, the gods they claimed as friends were also the gods of the elements. Quetzalcoatl had the wind at his side. The particular patron god of Teotihuacan, Tlaloc, was the god of rain. The deadly alternating cycle of droughts and storms that began in the 530s could mean only one of two things. Either the gods were angry with them, or they had simply given up caring for the city. Either way, the representative of the gods on Earth was in trouble. The results of the bad weather can be seen in the cemeteries of Teotihuacan, where skeletons begin to show malnutrition dating back to around 540. The death rate for people younger than 25 doubled, and then, sometime around or just after 600, the exact date is difficult to establish, a riot broke out in Teotihuacan. Along the Avenue of the Dead, the majestic temples and royal residences were vandalized and burned. The staircases leading up to the tops of the temples, where priests and kings met the gods, were broken apart. Statues were smashed, reliefs and carvings slashed and damaged. Excavations reveal skeletons, skulls smashed and bones broken, lying in corridors and rooms of the royal palaces. The fury of the destruction was aimed directly at the rulers, aristocrats, and priests, the elite of the city who had governed it and failed to keep it safe. Drought and flood affected the entire Central American land bridge, but the effects on the Zapotec capital Monte Alban are not quite as easy to trace. The torching of ceremonial buildings at Teotihuacan tells us that the people who had been moved into the city bore their rulers a fair amount of resentment. They had been living under an autocratic and heavy-handed government, and were ready to revolt when famine struck. Like the kings of Teotihuacan, the Zapotecs were not mild and gentle rulers. Reliefs in the remains of ceremonial buildings at Monte Alban show conquered tribal chiefs, probably from the more distant reaches of the Valley of Oaxaca, paraded naked and mutilated by their Zapotec captors. Nevertheless, they had not concentrated their populations into a single urban area, something that made Teotihuacan particularly vulnerable to famine and disease when food sources faltered. Their subjects, spread out over a much wider area, were not forced by hunger and misery into a single violent revolt, and the glyphs that we can read do not provide us with any chronicle of decline. But archaeology shows that between 550 and 650, the population of Monte Alban began to bleed out into the surrounding countryside. The villages and farms of the valley continued to be occupied. This was not the death of the Zapotecs, but instead a rejection of the city where its leaders lived and governed. The people survived, but the kingdom died. Like the rulers of Teotihuacan, the kings of Monte Alban had failed to convince their subjects that they were favored by the gods. What happened to the Mayan cities is even less clear. Unlike their neighbors, the Mayan cities had remained independent of each other. Fiercely autonomous, they fought each other for power as often as they acted in alliance. A few names and deeds survive. The king Sky Witness ruled for 10 years over the 50,000 residents of Calakmul. The king of Caracol, Lord Water, defeated his neighbor, the king of Tikal, and offered him as a sacrifice around 562. Ruins testify to the ingenuity of the Mayan builders. Canquen still stands out because of the enormous size of its royal palace. Chichen Itza had one of the most elaborate ball courts of any Mayan city, a court where players who represented life and death battled to slam a ball through a stone ring in a sacred ritual that remains obscure to us, although reliefs of decapitated players suggest that bloodshed played a large role. But most of the Mayan records, the elaborate calendars, genealogies, and chronologies, break off at 534, and the silence lasts for nearly a century. Archaeology must fill the gap. Outlying fortresses of the larger Mayan cities were burned. The population dwindled. Tree rings show long, cool, wet summers. Hunger stalked the Maya as well. The dearth of official records speaks its own message. When catastrophe struck, divine sanction could not preserve the power of kings once their people realized that the kings were helpless in the face of famine, drought, and flood. Author's note: the decades of destruction, the length of the break varied from 60 years at some cities to as long as 120 years at others, are generally considered to be the closing years of the early classic period in Mesoamerican history. The so-called pre-classic period stretches from around 1500 BC to AD 250. After this, archaeologists divide Mesoamerican civilization into early classic, circa 250 to 650, late classic, circa 650 to 900, early post-classic, 900 to 1200, and late post-classic, from 1200 to the Spanish conquest. See Richard E. W. Adams, Ancient Civilizations of the New World, Westview Press, 1997, chapters 2 and 3. Chapter 28, Great and Holy Majesty. Between 510 and 529, an Arabian king converts to Judaism, while the Emperor Justinian marries an actress and claims to speak for God. In Africa, just east of the Nile, the armies of Aksum were planning to invade Arabia. Their target, the Arabian kingdom of Himyar, lay just on the other side of the Red Sea. It had existed in southern Arabia for 600 years, expanding slowly until it controlled not only its ancient territory on the southeast corner of Arabia, but also the central Arabian tribes known as Kindites. The peoples of Himyar and Aksum were not all that different. Centuries of migration across the narrow strait between Africa and Arabia had produced African-Arabian kingdoms on both sides of the water. But Aksum had been Christian for 200 years, since its king Ezana had converted and forged a friendship with Constantine, and since then Aksum had also been an ally of the Romans. Most of Himyar, on the other hand, still followed traditional Arab ways, a useful phrase that covers a mass of divergent and contradicting customs. In 510, to be Arab meant nothing more than living on the Arabian Peninsula, and even that designation grew fuzzy up towards the north, where the peninsula shaded over into Persian and Roman-controlled land. Cities populated the coastal areas and the north, while nomadic tribes, known collectively as Bedouins, roamed the desert. And even though the Bedouins and the urban dwellers were descended, more or less, from the same tribal ancestors, they lived in competition for resources and in mutual disdain for each other's lifestyle. They were further divided by religion. A Nestorian form of Christianity had spread patchily down into some of the northern Arab cities, and even into some of the northern tribes. The Ghassanids, originally nomadic tribes from southern Arabia, had wandered northward in the previous century and settled down as farmers just south of Syria. There they converted to Christianity, and in 502 had agreed to become federati of Byzantium. But most Arabs were loyal to traditional deities who were honored at various shrines and about which we know almost nothing. For many years, the greatest of these shrines was found at the city of Mecca, halfway between Himyar and the Mediterranean Sea. The shrine was called the Kaaba. It housed the black stone, a sacred rock, possibly a meteorite, oriented towards the east. Tribes came from the interior to pay homage at the shrine, and war was prohibited for 20 miles around. From his corner of the peninsula, the king of Himyar, Dhun Nuwas, could see two great threats looming in the distance. To the northeast was Persia, which had already invaded the Arab peninsula at least once. Since Shapur II's expeditions in 325, the Lakhmids, Arab tribes who lived on the southern side of the Euphrates, had served as the Persian arm into Arabia, dominating the tribes nearby with the help of Persian cash and weapons. To the northwest was Byzantium, which had ambitions to spread into Arabia with the help of its two allied kings, the rulers of the Aksumites across the Red Sea and the Ghassanids south of Syria. Even with the Kindites as a buffer, Dhun Nuwas faced an uncertain future. So he took a highly unusual step. He converted to Judaism and declared Himyar to be a Jewish kingdom. Author's note, some sources suggest that the conversion took place a century earlier, under the king Karib Asad, ruled 385 to 420. But the weight of evidence seems to be with Dunuas. Either way, the motivation of the conversion would have been the same. Practically no one in the Middle Ages became Jewish as a way to get ahead, but Dunuas was already beating off periodic raids launched by Caleb, the Christian king of Aksum. He wanted to distance himself from the Christian allies of Byzantium without completely alienating Persia, and the Persian king, Kavad I, was kindly disposed towards Jews. As a Jewish monarch, Dunuas could pronounce the Byzantine and Aksumite Christians in his kingdom to be his enemies. He began to arrest the merchants of both nationalities and put them to death. His purge then extended to Himyarite natives, whom he suspected of belonging to a fifth column. Where Christianity had spread into his country, it had done so in the upper classes, the aristocrats of his society, who were the most likely challengers to his power in any case. They were concentrated most heavily in Najran, an oasis city at the intersection of caravan routes from Syria and Persia. Sometime between 518 and 520, Dunuas massacred the Christians of Najran. Rather than preserving his kingdom, the massacre destroyed it. News of the purge reached the Byzantine emperor in 521. Justin had just made his nephew, Justinian, consul, and the two men were dealing with renewed Persian hostility. Justin's predecessor, the emperor Anastasius, had handed over a yearly tribute to the Persian king Kavad I, a strategy that had yielded a number of relatively peaceful years. Justin decided to cease the payments, and in retaliation, Kavad I sent an army of Lakhmid mercenaries to attack the Byzantine borders. In early 521, Justin dispatched an ambassador to the king of the Lakhmids, Mundir, to try to negotiate a peace directly with the Persian-sponsored raiders. Among the ambassador's party was a Syrian churchman named Simeon of Beth Arsham. Afterwards, Simeon wrote to a fellow bishop describing the arrival of the news about the massacre. The Byzantine ambassador and King Mundir were negotiating in the Lakhmid army camp when a call went up from the sentries that another delegation was approaching. It was from Himyar, and carried letters from King Dunuas to his Arab colleague Mundir, telling him that the Christians of Najran were dead. According to Simeon, the letter described treachery and deceit. Dunuas had sent Jewish priests to the Christian churches in Najran, bearing promises that if the Christians would surrender peacefully, he would send them all across the Red Sea to Caleb of Aksum. He swore to them, Simeon writes, by the tablets of Moses, the Ark, and by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that no harm would befall them if they surrendered the city willingly. But when the Christians surrendered, Dunuas ordered them slaughtered. Men, women, and children were beheaded, their bodies burned in a flame-filled ditch. Dunuas concluded the letter by offering to pay King Mundir the weight of 3,000 denarii if he would convert to Judaism as well, forming an alliance of Arabic Jews who could unite against the Christians and drive Byzantine power entirely from the peninsula. Simeon's rhetoric is extreme, and his other writings reveal a malicious turn of mind, so his account should be taken with a tablespoon of salt. But his was apparently not the only report of the massacre. When the news reached Constantinople, Justin and Justinian threw the weight of Byzantium behind Caleb of Aksum's army, providing him with ships and soldiers and commissioning him to bring the Himyarite kingdom to an end. Procopius records the expedition. Caleb, whom he calls by the Greek name Helistheus, crossed the Red Sea with his fleet. Hearing of the approach, the remaining Christians in Himyar tattooed the cross on their arms, so that the attacking Aksumites would know them and spare their lives. Caleb met Dunuas in battle and defeated him. Later legends insist that Dunuas, seeing his army fall before the Aksumite attack, turned his horse towards the Red Sea in despair and rode into it, drowning himself and bringing an end to his kingdom, a baptism with no resurrection. Caleb of Aksum installed a Christian lieutenant of his own as governor, folding the territory into his own. He did not manage to keep control of the land across the Red Sea for long, but the Himyarite kingdom was no more. But Dunuas's letter gave birth to a rumor that still lives. The kingdom of Himyar had long ago spread across the old territory once governed by the Sabians, whose queen had journeyed north to see the great Israelite king Solomon in his capital of Jerusalem. And Dunuas was said to have sworn his oath to the Christians on the Ark. Perhaps the Ark of the Covenant, lost long ago, had in fact been taken down into Sabia by descendants of the queen, and Dunuas's oath meant that he had the Ark in his possession. And perhaps Caleb, plundering the capital city of Himyah after his victory, took the Ark back across the Red Sea into Aksum. It is still rumored to rest there, in the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion, in the ancient capital of the Aksumites. Author's note: other versions of this story have Solomon and the queen of the Sabians bearing a son together. The son, Menelik, takes the Ark across into Aksum, but none of these stories begin to show up until about the 8th century AD, and all of them probably stem from the historical events given above. Skirmishes between Byzantine and Persian armies continued, but for a time neither empire was willing to commit to full war. Kavad had temporarily lost his Arab mercenaries. After the destruction of Himyar, the Kindites, freed from the dominance of their southwestern neighbours, started a fight with the Lakhmid, which preoccupied the Lakhmid king Mundir for the next few years with the defence of his own people. The Emperor Justin was ill with an old army wound that caused him constant pain, and the consul Justinian was in love. He had fallen for an actress, a profession that in the Eastern Roman Empire had long combined on-stage performances with the off-stage servicing of male clients willing to pay. The actress who caught Justinian's eye was Theodora. She was barely 20 and had been forced to support herself since childhood in a world where women, without the protection of fathers or brothers, had little choice of jobs. Theodora's life is chronicled by Procopius, the Roman historian who gives such a sober and trustworthy chronology of Byzantium's military history in his History of the Wars. Procopius was a man's man. He admired strength and force, he scorned uncertainty and compromise, and he believed that a real emperor should be free of female influence. His joint biography of Justinian and Theodora, The Secret History, was written after Justinian married his actress, and after it became clear that Justinian, brilliant and mercurial, depended on his wife. It drips with vitriol. Despite the acidic tone, there is little reason to think that Procopius got his basic facts wrong. Theodora's past was well known to her contemporaries. Her father had been a bear trainer who worked in the half-time shows given by the Greens between chariot races. He had died of illness, leaving his wife with three small girls under the age of 7. The Greens had hired another trainer, and in order to survive, the mother had forced the girls to appear before the Blues as entertainers. Entertainment led to prostitution, and by the time Theodora reached puberty, she had already been in a brothel for years. Procopius chalks this up to Theodora's insatiable appetite. He claims that she could sleep with upward of 40 men per night without satisfying her lust. But a darker picture emerges from even his sharp-tongued account. "She was extremely clever and had a biting wit," he writes. "She complied with the most outrageous demands without the slightest hesitation, and she was the sort of girl who, if somebody walloped her or boxed her ears, would make a jest of it and roar with laughter." She had, after all, little other choice. When she was still in her teens, she caught the eye of a Roman official who was heading down to North Africa to take charge of a five-city district known as the Pentapolis. She went with him to his new post, but once in North Africa he threw her out. She made her way along the coast, finding herself without even the necessities of life, Procopius says, which from then on she provided in her customary fashion by making her body the tool of her lawless trade, and ended up in the Byzantine city of Alexandria in Egypt. There she became a heretic. In the theological wars of the previous century, Alexandria had lost prestige. Despite the age and size of the city's Christian community, the Bishop of Alexandria had been placed below both the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, and the Bishop of Constantinople, the Patriarch, in the Christian hierarchy. Resentment over this ordering of church authority made Alexandria a welcome haven for Christians who found themselves out of step with the Chalcedonian Christianity of Constantinople and Rome. In fact, Alexandrian Christians tended to think that the Chalcedonian creed had not gone far enough in condemning Nestorianism, the belief that Christ had two separate natures, human and divine. The priests at the Council of Chalcedon thought of themselves as monophysitic, and they had carefully rejected language that might make it sound as though Christians worshipped more than one divinity. Jesus and God are one person and one subsistence, the Chalcedonian Creed said, not as if Christ were parted or divided into two persons. But the Creed also maintained that Christ had two natures, and that although those natures were without confusion, division, or separation, the characteristic property of each nature was preserved. The Council of Chalcedon had walked as close to the edge of monophysitism as it could without stepping over, and the Alexandrians were unhappy with this phrasing. They were unhappy because it was being imposed on them, and also because they wanted no hint of two-ness in their theology. The farther east you lived, the more aware you were that the Persians believed in a pantheon of deities, and the more important it became to mark off the differences between you and your foreign neighbours by insisting that you believed in only one God. Timothy III, the Bishop of Alexandria, not only defended monophysitism, but welcomed into his city churchmen who had been thrown out of Rome, Constantinople, and Antioch for being insufficiently Chalcedonian. Among them was Julian of Halicarnassus, who taught that Christ was so divine that even his human body was incorruptible, meaning that the incarnation was real only in appearance. Theodora was converted to Christianity, and for the rest of her life she held on to the extreme monophysitism that she had learned in the early days of her faith. But she did not stay in Alexandria long after her conversion. Even Procopius has to acknowledge that once she had been baptized, she gave up her livelihood, and, having no way to live, went to stay with an old friend, another actress who was currently living in Antioch. The friend, Macedonia, had discovered a new way to survive. She too had given up prostitution in favor of joining the imperial secret police. Antioch was the third most important city in Byzantium, just behind Constantinople and Alexandria, and Justinian apparently had a network of spies and informers to keep him abreast of any unseen developments. Macedonia was one of these informers. Procopius says that she reported to her boss by writing letters, but at some point Justinian must have visited the city and asked for a personal update, because Macedonia introduced him to her friend. Theodora was no longer in the business of supplying companionship for cash, and Justinian, 20 years her senior, smitten beyond all reason, promised to marry her. By 522 she was living in Constantinople, in a house he provided, and he was trying to talk his uncle and aunt into approving the marriage. The complication was a law passed by Constantine 200 years earlier, meant to guard the morals of his officials. A consul, Justinian was forbidden to marry an actress. But the greater obstacle appears to have been his aunt, Justin's wife, Euphemia. Euphemia announced that she would never approve of the marriage, not because the young woman had been in a brothel, but because she was a monophysite. Sometime around 524, Euphemia died. Almost at once, the elderly Justin agreed to pass a law revoking Constantine's ban. Women who have been on the stage, he decreed, but who have changed their mind and have abandoned a dishonorable profession, shall be entirely cleansed of all stain. Legally redeemed by imperial fiat, retired actresses could marry anyone they pleased, and as soon as the law passed, Justinian and Theodora were married at the Church of the Holy Wisdom in Constantinople. The law was Justin's last major act as emperor. He was approaching 80, often ill and weary. On April 1st, 527, he crowned Justinian as his co-emperor and heir. In the hot days of early August, Justin died. His nephew became emperor, and Theodora, still only in her 20s, was crowned empress. For some decades, the crown of Constantinople had been worn by military men, concerned above all else with protecting the borders of the empire from Persians and Huns, with administration and taxes, treaties and alliances. Justinian was not oblivious to these matters, but he was, above all, a Christian emperor, and he took his duties as God's representative on earth more seriously than any emperor since Theodosius I. In 528 he appointed a committee to collect and rewrite the unwieldy, and often contradictory, mass of laws passed by Eastern emperors over several centuries into a single coherent code. The first volume of this code was completed by the following year, and Justinian's own contributions to it reveal the exact place he occupied in his own ideal universe. What is greater or holier than the imperial majesty, he asked rhetorically, and then decreed, every interpretation of laws by the emperor, whether made on petitions, in judicial tribunals, or in any other manner, shall be considered valid and unquestioned. For if at the present time it is conceded only to the emperor to make laws, it should be befitting only the imperial power to interpret them. The emperors will rightly be considered as the sole maker and interpreter of laws. Nor does this contradict the founders of the ancient laws, because the imperial majesty gave them the same right. Greater or holier, Justinian claimed for himself the double legitimacy of Roman custom and Christian authority, seeing no contradiction between the two. He was both the heir of Augustus Caesar and the representative of Christ on earth. His code regulated taxes, oaths, land ownership, and matters of belief. Concerning the High Trinity was the first regulation in the first book of the code. We acknowledge, Justinian himself wrote, the only begotten Son of God, God of God, born of the Father, before the world and without time, co-eternal with the Father, the maker of all things. Something had happened, almost invisibly, in the 18 months that Justinian had been on the throne. His word had become law, and not just secular law, but sacred law as well. Despite his claim to wield the ancient Roman Imperium, Justinian's assertion that his authority was sacred was a new assertion. It needed the force of Christian theology behind it, that theology which said there was one and only one right way to God, one and only one word, one and only one Son, so one and only one man with the final authority to speak for God on earth. The Roman pantheon could not lend such weight to imperial law. The autocratic Roman emperors of the past had used force and violence as their ultimate justification for carrying out their will. Justinian was not shy about using force, but for him, force was a means. His ultimate appeal to power was the identification between his will and the will of God. No competitors for authority were permitted. The Code of 529 forbade any adherence to the old Greek and Roman religions to teach in public. As a result, the Academy at Athens, the last school where Platonic philosophy was taught, shut down. Its faculty emigrated to Persia. All the finest flower of those who did philosophy in our time, writes the contemporary historian Agathias, since they did not like the prevailing Christian opinion and thought the Persian constitution to be far better, went away to a different and pure place, with the intention of spending the rest of their lives there. Chapter 29. Pestilence. Between 532 and 544, Justinian and Theodora survive a riot, Byzantine armies defeat Vandals and Ostrogoths, but not Persians, and bubonic plague docks at the Golden Horn. In 532, the Persian and Byzantine emperors decided to forego any more border spats long enough to solve their own domestic troubles. They swore a truce with each other called the Eternal Peace. It lasted for 8 years. The emperor Kavad had just died at the age of 82, naming his favorite and third eldest son, Khosru, as his heir. Since he wasn't the eldest, Khosru found himself obliged to defend his right to the crown against his other brothers. He also had to put down an opportunistic revolt of the remaining Mazdakites. When they rioted, Khosru massacred them, chopped off the heads of their leaders, and in an act of poetic justice, shared out all their property among the poor of Persia. While Khosru was trying to establish his power in Persia, Justinian was on the edge of losing it in Constantinople. His uncle Justin had barely maintained the empire in its present state. Justinian was a reformer, a builder, an energetic hands-on emperor with his fingers in almost every imperial pie. Procopius says that he had little need of rest or food, sometimes sleeping only an hour a night and going for a day or more without bothering to eat. His vast law code project was just the tip of the iceberg. He had plans for great building projects in Constantinople, for reconquering lost lands in the west, for burnishing the empire into a glorious kingdom of God on earth. All of this took tax money, and the new taxes Justinian imposed were widely unpopular. To support his policies, Justinian appealed to the loyalty of the Blues, the faction he had supported since his youth. But the factions were inherently unstable. They were armed and ambitious and inclined to pick fights whenever possible. Factional loyalty was essentially irrational. They care neither for things divine nor human in comparison with conquering, Procopius wrote, and when their fatherland is in the most pressing need and suffering unjustly, they pay no heed if only it is likely to go well with their faction. For Justinian, blue support was a foundation of sand. In January of 532, two criminals, one of whom happened to be a blue, the other a green, were condemned to hanging by the courts at Constantinople. They were marched out for public execution, but the hangman proved incompetent. Twice in a row, the ropes failed to function properly, and the criminals hit the ground still alive. Before the hangman could try for a lucky third, monks from a nearby monastery intervened and insisted that the criminals be given sanctuary. It was too late. The torture had already aroused the watchers. Both the Greens and the Blues rioted, not against each other, but joining forces against the government of Constantinople. With a somewhat legitimate grievance fueling them, the factionalists went wild. City employees were indiscriminately slaughtered. Buildings all over Constantinople were set on fire. The Church of the Holy Wisdom, parts of the palace complex, the marketplace, and dozens of houses of the wealthy all went up in flames. The rioters began to demand that Justinian turn over to them two city officials who were particularly unpopular, so that they could carry out their own executions. When the officials failed to appear, the fighting grew more violent. Rioters stormed through the streets shouting, "Nicar! Victory!" Meanwhile, Justinian, Theodora, and the high officials of Constantinople shut themselves up in the palace and remained quietly there. Perhaps they hoped that the rebellion would burn itself out. Instead, the rioters went in search of a new ruler. Hypatius, the nephew of the dead Emperor Anastasius, lived in Constantinople with his wife. He had gone home and barred his doors, but the rioters dragged him out of his house against his will and declared him emperor, and then escorted him to a throne they had set up in the Hippodrome, the huge chariot-racing venue in the center of the city. At this, Justinian decided it would be best to make for the nearest harbor and flee in one of the royal ships docked there. Theodora stopped him. "For one who has been an emperor, it is unendurable to be a fugitive," she told him. "If you wish to save yourself, there is no difficulty. There is the sea, here are the boats. But consider, after you have been saved, you may wish that you could exchange that safety for death. For myself, I accept the ancient saying that royalty is a good burial shroud." Theodora had spent all of her earlier years struggling for survival. She had no intention of returning to that life. The speech snapped Justinian out of his panic, and the besieged emperor and his courtiers decided to hold on a little longer. Justinian's chief general, Belisarius, and the commander of the Illyricum army, who happened to be in Constantinople on business, formed a plan. They had already summoned reinforcements from nearby cities, and those soldiers would arrive at the city shortly. With the new forces behind them, the two men would break in through opposite doors of the Hippodrome with whatever soldiers they could muster, and hope that the surprise attack would panic the crowd into stampeding. Meanwhile, one of Justinian's secretaries, posing as a traitor to the imperial cause, passed the news to the leaders of the rebellion that Justinian had fled, which reduced their wariness. Another official went to the Hippodrome with a bag of cash and started to pay out bribes, producing dissension between Greens and Blues, who had previously been in alliance. When the reinforcements arrived, the two generals crept through the streets, which now were largely deserted. Everyone was in the Hippodrome cheering Hypatius. Belisarius assembled his men at the small door right next to the throne where Hypatius sat, while the Illyricum commander went around to the entrance known as the Gate of Death. When the soldiers barged into the crowd, the hoped-for panic erupted. Belisarius and his colleague mopped up the rebellion. Procopius says that over 30,000 people were slaughtered in that single night. The next day, Hypatius was captured and assassinated by some unknown and useful member of the army. The Nika revolt was the last challenge to Justinian's power. For the next 3 decades, he would rule with an autocracy that stemmed partly from his conviction that God had put him in charge of the empire, partly from the determination to keep such a rebellion from ever threatening him again. His partiality for the Blues was markedly diminished, and the factions remained at odds with each other for the rest of his reign. The revolt left its mark on the city. Dozens of public buildings had been burned, and large swaths of the richer neighborhoods had been leveled. Justinian put into place an enormous building program, led by his master builder Anthemius of Tralles. Enormous glittering edifices rose on the ruins. The Church of the Holy Wisdom, the Hagia Sophia, became the jewel of the restored city. Anthemius, who was also an accomplished mathematician, designed a new dome supported by the arches that Procopius found almost magical. Author's note: Anthemius was both an architect and a mathematician of note. He wrote several treatises covering the properties of cones, parabolas, and ellipses that were studied for centuries afterward. See, for example, Roman Architects in the Architect, Chapters in the History of the Profession. "It is marvellous in its grace, but altogether terrifying," he writes, "for it seems somehow to float in the air on no firm basis, but to be poised aloft to the peril of those inside it." The ceiling was overlaid with gold inset with stones, which added streaks of coloured light to the shining yellow surface. The inner sanctuary was lined with 40,000 pounds of silver, and the church was filled with relics and treasures. It was like a meadow with its flowers in full bloom, Procopius marvels, the purple of some, the green tint of others, those on which crimson glows, those from which white flashes. While polishing up the capital city, Justinian also put into play his plans to conquer some of the lost land in the west. The kingdoms of the once barbarians occupied the former provinces, the Visigoths in Hispania, the Vandals in North Africa, the Ostrogoths in Italy, the Franks in Gaul. But as far as Justinian was concerned, these were not kingdoms, they were overgrowths on Roman land. He intended not to invade, but to reclaim. Justinian still thought of that western land as Roman, and thus as rightfully his. He settled on North Africa as his first target, and put Belisarius at the head of the campaign. Belisarius set sail from Constantinople with 5,000 cavalry and 10,000 foot soldiers. He arrived at the coast of North Africa at an opportune moment. Half of the Vandal army was elsewhere, putting down an uprising. The Vandal king Gelimer, a distant relation of Gaiseric, the kingdom's founder, had too few soldiers to keep the Byzantines out. Instead, he gathered up his bodyguard and fled from his palace in Carthage. Procopius was with Belisarius when the general arrived at the city. "No one hindered us from marching into the city at once," he wrote in his account of the invasion. "For the Carthaginians opened the gates and burned lights everywhere, and the city was brilliant with the illumination that whole night, and those of the Vandals who had been left behind were sitting as suppliants in the sanctuaries." The Byzantines occupied the city peacefully. Gelimer, finally managing to recall his absent forces, had to attack his own city in an attempt to keep his throne, but his forces were wiped out. In that single battle, fought in mid-December of 533, the Vandals were shattered, their nation destroyed. Ever since the death of Gaiseric in 477, they had been declining. Procopius says that by 533, the walls of Carthage were crumbling and dilapidated. Gaiseric's 50-year rule had established the nation, and they had been unable to survive without him. They had never evolved an identity beyond that of followers of Gaiseric. Belisarius returned to Constantinople in triumph. In 535, Justinian dispatched him on his second western campaign, against Italy, where the symbolic heart of the empire still lay, and where the land was very imperfectly under the control of the Ostrogoth king. Enduring years of bitter quarrelling between his regents and his noblemen, the teenage king, Athalaric, had been driven to seek comfort in wine. He had drunk himself to death by the time he was 18, and his elderly relative, Theodahad, had been elected to be the new Ostrogoth ruler. Belisarius landed on Sicily in late 535, and conquered it without difficulty. He then moved on to the shores of Italy and captured the ancient coastal city of Naples, which had been under Ostrogothic control. The defeat unseated the elderly Theodahad. The Ostrogoths, displeased by the city's fall and by Theodahad's attempts to make peace by selling part of his land to Justinian, allowed a warrior named Witkis to dethrone and kill him. The old Germanic custom of picking a war leader as king was in full force, as Witkis himself announced in a royal letter to his people. "We inform you that our kinsmen the Goths, amid defence of circling swords, raising us in ancestral fashion upon a shield, have, by divine guidance, bestowed on us the kingly dignity, thus making arms the emblem of honour to one who has earned all his renown in war. For know that not in the corner of a presence chamber, but in wide-spreading plains I have been chosen king. And that not the dainty discourse of flatterers, but the blare of trumpets announced my elevation, that the Gothic people, roused by the sound to a kindling of their inborn valour, might once more gaze upon a soldier king." While Witkis crowned himself in Ravenna, Belisarius advanced from the coast. In December of 536, he captured Rome itself. The easy victory in North Africa was not repeated. It took the Byzantine general another 4 years to advance as far as Ravenna and capture Vitkis. But in 540, he took the Ostrogoth king prisoner and declared himself master of Italy. For the first time in over 100 years, the empire teetered on the edge of a sort of restoration, but communications between the emperor and his great general had disintegrated. Justinian became convinced that Belisarius intended to set himself up as king of Italy. Rather than allowing Belisarius to consolidate his conquests, he ordered the general to return to Constantinople. Belisarius began to travel back to Constantinople with Vitkis in tow, leaving a skeleton force in Italy to assert Byzantine control. To protect the Byzantine garrisons, Justinian made treaties with three northern tribal confederations, the Gepids, the Lombards, and the Heruls, convincing them to settle along the Italian border northeast of the mountain and act as buffers, should any other wandering peoples attempt to invade. But as soon as Belisarius was gone, the remaining Ostrogoths elected a new king, a soldier named Totila, and began to fight back against Byzantine occupation. For the next decades, control of Italy would seesaw back and forth between Ostrogoth and Byzantine forces. Vitkis died in captivity. Justinian's tribal allies remained along the edges of the territory with their backs to the conflict. No one had enough men to bring the war to a decisive end. The war has not turned out well to the advantage of either side, an Ostrogothic ambassador remarked, which was an understatement. The wars in Italy and North Africa, not to mention the enormous building projects in Constantinople, had drained the treasury. The Eternal Peace stipulated that Byzantium would pay the Persian Empire a yearly tribute, but Justinian could no longer afford it. The payments went into arrears. In June of 540, Khosrew marched into Syria and sacked the ancient city of Antioch in punishment. Belisarius had not yet arrived back in Constantinople with his men, and without them Justinian simply did not have the manpower to fight back. He sent Khosrew messages promising that he would send the tardy tribute just as soon as he was able to raise it. Khosrew accepted the offer and began to retreat, very slowly, back through the Syrian province, taking captives from Antioch with him. As he went, he repaid himself for the campaign by demanding ransom money from the Byzantine cities along the way, threatening to burn them if they did not comply. Meanwhile, Justinian managed to scrape together the tribute, but Khosrew insisted on leaving a Persian garrison within Roman territory. He also embarked on a building project designed to irritate the Byzantine emperor. He ordered his architects to construct an exact plan of the sacked city of Antioch, and then built a street-by-street replica of it in his own territory, at Al-Madain. He settled his captives in it. The Arab historian Al-Tabari writes, "When they entered the city's gate, the denizens of each house went to the new house so exactly resembling their former one in Antioch that it was as if they had never left the city." Most of the Persians called it Al-Rumia, town of the Greeks, but Khosrew called it built better than Antioch. Anticipating the beginning of war, he also built walls to fortify the city of Derbent, keeper of the Caspian gates. Justinian, not anxious to scrape his bare treasury to fund yet more fighting, had sent a letter of appeal asking for peace to be restored, but Khosrew ignored it. He was determined to bring a formal end to the eternal peace, and he invaded again in 541. By this time, Belisarius was back in the east, taking command of the Byzantine defense. He won a few smallish victories, but before long the war began to swing the Persian way. Khosrew's armies captured the fortress of Petra and the surrounding lands, and Belisarius's attempt to retake the fortress of Nisibis failed. The fighting had not gone well for the Byzantine army, but a blacker enemy hovered. In 542, just as Khosrew was crossing over the Euphrates for yet another assault on the Byzantine frontier, a ship docked at the Golden Horn. It brought much-needed grain from the mouth of the Nile. The cold, dark summers of the previous years had reduced food supplies, and the population of the Eastern Empire was already hungrier and weaker than normal. But not long after the ship threw down its anchor, a sickness began to spread along the waterfront. It was an illness known to the ancients, but new to the people of Constantinople. Sudden fever, swellings in the groin and armpit, coma, and death. Physicians, dissecting the bodies of the dead in an effort to find the cause, found strange abscesses filled with pus and dead tissue at the center of the swellings. They were at a loss. Nothing seemed to stop the spread of the disease. At first, the deaths from the illness were no worse than from any other epidemic making its way through the crowded suburbs of Constantinople. But within days, the mortalities had doubled and then doubled again. This was no mere epidemic. It had become a catastrophe without parallel. A pestilence, writes Procopius, by which the whole human race came near to being annihilated. The sickness burned through the city at full force for 3 entire months. The tale of dead reached 5,000 each day, Procopius tells us, and then came to 10,000, and still more than that. Some victims broke out with black pustules, about as large as a lentil, and died vomiting blood. Others, driven delirious by high fever, died screaming in pain when the swellings grew gangrenous and burst. Some took agonizing days to die. Others walked from their houses healthy and were struck down in the road by fever so sudden that they fell in their tracks and lay on the road until they died. Nobody would go out of doors without a tag upon which his name was written, and which hung on his neck or arm, writes John of Ephesus, who lived through the plague. That way their disfigured bodies could be identified and claimed by surviving relatives. The sickness of Constantinople was bubonic plague, named for the swellings or buboes carried by the fleas that travelled from port to port on ships' rats. Bubonic plague had not struck Constantinople before, but the cold, wet summers after 353 had a three-sided consequence. The drop in temperature provided the Yersinia pestis bacterium, the active agent of the plague, the perfect environment in which to flourish. Years of poor harvests had forced Constantinople to increase its grain imports, bringing ships from all over the Mediterranean to the Golden Horn. And the people of Byzantium were weaker, hungrier, and more vulnerable than ever before. It was only a matter of time before one of those ships brought death to the city. The population died, and died, and died. The historian Evagrius Scholasticus suffered from the swelling and survived, one of the few to live through the sickness. But he lost his wife, his children, and his grandchildren. Some were desirous of death, he wrote in his otherwise dispassionate chronicle, on account of the utter loss of their children and friends, and placed themselves as much as possible in